I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome everyone to Spark My Muse. Today, my guest is Dr. Amy Banks. She is an MD and was an instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. She's now the director of advanced training at the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute at the Wesley Centers for Women, and she has a private practice in Lexington, Massachusetts, which specializes in relational psychopharmacology and therapy for people who suffer from chronic disconnection. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
And so what were some of the early influences that set you on a path to study what you have studied in the neuroscience of relationships?
It's a good question, you know. So I'm a psychiatrist by training, which means I went up through medical school and then did a residency. And I did a residency in the Boston area, and it was very focused on these human models of development that were about separating and individuating and, you know, standing on your own two feet. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting is actually during that time of my residency, I had as a supervisor somebody that was working in this field of relational cultural theory, right? That really it was a theory of human development created in this Boston area that said, you know, it's not about separating and standing on your own two feet. Really, health and well-being is about relationships. And this woman, Pam Peck, was familiar with the Stone Center and the work that was being done in this model. And I feel very lucky to have experienced that early on. And so as I left my residency, that really kind of stayed, you know, heart and center in my work life and how I approached therapy and actually most anything in life. And then, of course, in the last 20 years, what has happened is science has had the tools, you know, with scanning machines and whatnot to actually look at the brain and start documenting the ways that this is that theory was sort of prophetic, if you will, that in fact, this is just what happens, is that relationships really are central to our health and well-being. And we have this whole neurophysiology in our brains and our bodies that support that.
Mm. And so rather than making these sort of guesses through psychology, the neuroscience part is really how the brain functions and watching what it does on scans. And maybe you can unpack a little bit of what we're talking about when we say the neuroscience of relationships, so if people are unfamiliar.
Yeah, what I have done in my work in the last couple of years is I sort of think of myself as a bridger or a kind of bridging two worlds. So there's sort of this science world that has lots of information, but isn't that user accessible, right? And then there are the people that want it, and even the clinicians and whatnot, and they have, you know, theories, and they're doing the personal, interpersonal work, and I sort of wanted to bring these two together. And so I came up with this model. It's called a care model, but the point is I began to talk about literally what are the neural pathways in our brain that allow us, or what are needed to be strong and robust in order to have really healthy relationships, right? And so I break those down into the four neural pathways for connection. It's reductionistic, but I think it gives people a good snapshot of how concrete this is, right? That we're not talking about theory at this point. We're talking about literally paths of nerves that allow you to feel calmer, like that feed back into your stress response system so you feel calmer when you're in a healthy relationship, right? Mm-hmm. And I can go into some of the specifics if you want, but I don't...
I can't wait to jump into that, the four pathways, and hopefully we'll get to that in just a minute. But I wanted to a little bit go into some of the ways that, like one of the statistics that was kind of shocking and horrifying, in a way building a case for why this is so important. And one of them is that incredibly shocking statistic of 340% of people who have poor social support will have a premature death. Yeah. And it's like one of those, like,
shocking,
are you
right?
kidding me? And so it's, our culture, unlike other cultures in the world is so independent and pioneering, and you're rewarded mm-hmm. for your independence. And yet,
yes.
when we don't have social support, we die younger.
Exactly. So that's I think this is, I'm so glad that you brought that up and focused on that, because, a large part of the work that I'm really trying to do in talking about this is to really get people to understand that this hyper-independent, stand on your own 2 feet, undermines your pathways of connection. Mm. And because we are literally built as pack animals, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. We need to be in our tribes and our packs for our physical health. It's not just our emotional health, right? It's not just that we're going to have less anxiety and less depression. Mm. We have less heart disease and less cancer and less drug addiction and, on and on and on it goes. I mean, and the research is incredibly robust in this. There's a guy, Dean Ornish, who was the big cardiac guy of about 15, 20 years ago, but sort of 6-7 years ago, he wrote a book called Love and Survival, and he documents all of the studies that could make this connection. The higher risk of death when you're isolated, when you're disconnected, that. And it's sort of like, why in the world isn't this being plastered everywhere, right?
Mm, yeah. It's interesting, too, because I noticed a recent popularity about, protecting yourself and creating boundaries. You talk about this, people talk about boundaries and keeping yourself safe against bad relationships, which is important to a point where we don't want to cause ourselves undue harm. But you talk about something very different, looking things very differently and thinking about relationships as porous. Maybe you can just unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I somewhat provocatively actually start my book, Wired to Connect, with the statement that boundaries are overrated, right?
And right.
I think that societies or cultures or, however you want to frame that, that believe in separation, right, are really overly invested in these boundaries between two people. Right, the boundaries separate you, as you said, from the unsafe world around you, and some of the safety may be, other people. Mm-hmm. And what if you look at the world through a relational lens, you begin to see that actually the boundaries, right, that space between you and me, is the place where the deepest, richest interchanges happen in relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what we need to be doing is not putting up walls. We need to be learning really specific, concrete relational skills, right? And I'd tie that to, we really need to be building these pathways for connection. We need them to be strong so that we know how to navigate in that space. So we can be mad at someone and share that and not blow up or, have to flee because it's too much. That we can really navigate those difficult places in relationship, right? And so boundaries feel just inadequate, mm-hmm. When you're really trying to build and grow a relationship, because it's in, so when it's more porous and when there is a clear seeing the other person, there's much more back and forth and clarity.
I'm noticing a lot too that people are more, maybe not more conflict averse, but because of relationships being able to be mediated through technology and a text instead of a phone call or whatever, that there's more ability to create boundaries that maybe weren't there before between people. And so perhaps even skills are deteriorating more. And how do you suggest that people work on whether just seeing their relationships as more porous or thinking of things differently than a boundary-centered way of viewing relationships?
Yeah, so part of my dream for the world, right, or for our culture, is that we start teaching relational skills differently and the neurobiology of relationship, at the same time that we're handing a child their first iPhone, right? Which we know now is going, kind of lower, lower, lower. You can now prop a child up with an iPhone. But if you think about it, right, the the child needs to have this information. It's sort of, you know where your nose is and what it does, and but do you know what your mirror neurons are and how they allow you to feel other people's, you know, feelings, right? So that sometimes you're having an emotion and it may not even be coming from you. You know, that's sort of sophisticated interpersonal dynamic that most adults don't know about and certainly kids don't know about, right?
Right.
And then you give them these things, these devices, where they can make shortcuts. They can even make shortcuts to their interacting. And as you say, you know, you can block somebody, whatever. Now, you know, we've long had the silent treatment and, you know, hanging up the phone. And we've had versions of this. But right. It's just that people have both the potential to be in so much more frequent contact, right? And in so much more frequent disconnect, in a sense. And so, you know, getting it, like, if you give somebody something that says, you know, I can defriend you from Facebook, you want them to get the ramifications for that, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you might not get the obnoxious email. What's that going to feel like to the other person? How do you keep growing these pathways for connection so you get the impact, right? Mm. And I say, I mean, a lot of my work, or exercises that I ask people to do actually includes stuff online, because we're online, right? And it can be used as such a tool for connection, right? You're doing it. You're educating. You're, you know, it can be such an amazing tool, but it's not an amazing tool if you're in a culture that actually undermines relationship, right?
Right.
Because then you don't, the whole culture doesn't build the skill set it needs to manage that.
Mm. Well, can you explain a little bit about mirroring neurons for people who are not aware?
Yeah, sure. So this is work that was done initially in Parma, Italy. And, you know, people have always been sort of fascinated by how it is that human beings kind of know each other, right? And there's the knowing where you tell me something about yourself and I remember it, but there's also that knowing. You know, you go into Dunkin' Donuts, everybody knows they're getting coffee. You know, somebody reaches a hand out, you know you're going for a shake, or if, you know, what the context. So there's a bodily knowing, right? And it used to be that people would... the theories would be that people make up stories about somebody else and what they're doing, and then they test it out kind of internally, and there was sort of a cumbersome process of how we know people. In the last 20 years, what's been clear is that there are these pathways that all mammals have, actually. So it's not just us human beings. Your dogs will have them as well, right? These mirror neurons. And they're pathways that actually grow and develop in the context of human relationship, or in the context of relationship, because it also can be with your dog or other mammals, but in the context of relationship, that fire, so that you, part of how you know somebody else is that there is an internal mimicking of their actions, their feelings, their sensations in your own body. Right? And then that's concrete. That's not a sort of, made up thing in your head. So if I'm watching you, and this is an exercise I do often when I teach, is I'll rub my hands together, right? In this, and what's amazing, if you just stand in front of somebody else and you rub your hands together, and then you ask them how their hands feel, they'll say, oh my God, they feel warm. You know, and like, I can say, rub your hands together, and my hands feel warm.
Right.
You know what I mean? I don't know if you noticed that, but you know, you can sort of feel the friction. And it's because a whole network is activated in your brain, if you're watching me do that, that is showing you internally how I'm feeling. Right? That's the mirror neuron system. Happens around empathy. Why is it that you go to a movie and you see a sad scene, or somebody in particular, if you relate to them, and you find yourself crying? That's mirror neurons.
Oh, yeah. Wow. And that really, as those get built up, you are building stronger and stronger pathways. But then if you're isolated,
yes,
those pathways are really not as strong.
Exactly. They're literally not as strong, right? Yeah. You don't have that experience.
That I also have. I listened to you on a few other podcasts as a way of researching for this interview, and I was really intrigued about what you said about introversion and loneliness, and the difference between being alone and loneliness and some of the ways you were explaining about introversion. And I thought that that was just some really profound things in there. One of the things you said about introversion is that was really helpful, I think, to people who are introverted. I feel more introverted as I get older. And I thought that was interesting. It was like when you're introverted, the times you cherish times with other people, but they last longer in your interior life or something along those lines. And just how much people who are introverted do need all the same connections, but they have like a longer half-life or something like that. Maybe you can go into that.
That's right. Yeah. And to really be thinking about it, right? Because there's sort of this, if you're introverted, you don't need people in the same way, right? Mm. You know, it's focused on your time alone. I need downtime and all of that. And and to really get the difference between being alone and well-connected versus isolated, right? And so people, they're, if you are an introvert, you go out, you hang out with a friend. Maybe you do one or two friends rather than the whole group. You kind of get filled up. You get a nice stimulation because all of these pathways for connection, right, need to have their workouts, right? And so it's not that when you're an introvert, you don't need your daily workout. You just don't need the same amount of it to keep those robust. And then and when you go back home, you're not going home to isolation, right? Isolation is by definition to the human being stress. You go home, you might be, hanging out with your music, maybe you're going for a hike, maybe maybe it's your pet or whatever, maybe you're reading a good book and you're hanging out with those characters, but that these pathways are vibrant and they're rich, but they're just there and okay, right? Yeah.
And so would you say that I've known people who are more isolated and it seems as though it self-perpetuates, and so they might get maybe an anxiety disorder after that. And does that make sense with your research as well?
Totally. Mm. Yeah. Yes, when you're isolated, and again, because we are literally built to buffer each other, we feel safer in a group for all kinds of reasons. And, it doesn't mean that you have to have somebody attached to your hip all the time, but you have to know that there's somebody who could attach to your hip, right? You need to know that there is somebody there for you. And when you don't have that, which is becoming an increasing problem actually in our country, when you don't have that, then it's sort of like you're an exposed nerve ending, right? Literally, there's this whole thing. I mean, it brings up one of these other pathways that I talk about, which is the smart vagus nerve. And I think this is a good place to mention it because, research has shown that that there is a third pathway to what's called the autonomic nervous system. And most people are familiar with the fight or flight response, that sympathetic nervous system, right? Sympathetic and parasympathetic, which is kind of rest and relaxation. So, fight, flight, and then kind of rest, relax, and then actually in life-threatening danger, that parasympathetic goes into freeze. But that's, we're used to thinking about those two in terms of the stress response system and relaxation. But in the last 15 years, this other pathway has been identified, the smart vagus nerve that innervates your muscles of facial expression, your inner ears, your throat, your actually where you swallow. And the whole point of this pathway is to help modulate your stress response system in relationship, right? So that when you have a robust smart vagus or good vagal tone, as people call it, what happens is that when you think about a person that's close to you or a system that says stand down, you're safe. Mm. Right. And so that you want to stimulate over and over and over and over and over. We want to have really, really strong vagal tone so that we can do it. Strong vagal tone is one of the most important things that you need for conflict, right? So that you can engage in conflict, speak your mind, hear somebody else, even if it's not what you want to hear, and not have to flip off into your stress response system, your sympathetic nervous system, right? Or freeze or flee or what have you. That vagal tone modulates kind of that stress level. And when you have chronic isolation, what happens is your sympathetic nervous system is getting a big time workout. right? And so it's sort of, you don't have as much of the vagal tone online, and you're just chronically stressed.
And you would probably see a lot more things as threats when they really wouldn't be.
You got it. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And so if let's say you're in a situation where it sort of can't be helped, maybe you're home alone for a job that you do and or something like that, and then you find yourself getting more anxious and more isolated, the thing to do would just be like work on outside connections, or like how would you make sure to strengthen that and get that?
Yeah, so if you're somebody that works at home a lot, right? Mm-hmm. But then you are going to be saying, you know what, I should plan regularly dinner with a friend a couple of times a week, right? Or a conversation on the phone with, you know, my best friend, or my, you know, is there somebody in your family or whatever. You want to build those in. Because that isolation, that just being home, alone, not getting that feedback, not getting that stimulation into these pathways can, in fact, lead to kind of a downward spiral.
Mm. Well, maybe we can talk now about your care model. And I've heard it before. It's really good because it kind of provides an easy way to remember it too. And all these pathways, I think, are fantastic and practical for us to implement.
Yeah. So what the CARE program is, that it was, again, a way to bring all of this information together so that people can use it to try to strengthen their pathways and strengthen their relationships, which then feeds into strengthening the pathways for connection, which then strengthens the relationship. So you get sort of this, you know, kind of feedback loop in the right direction up and towards better physical health, mental health, and relational health, right? Mm-hmm. So what I did is basically came up with an assessment tool, okay, that people, and I like to describe it as, you know, taking a like kind of 3D snapshot of your relational world. And I have people do a relational assessment. There are 20 questions that reflect the qualities of a healthy relationship and also the functioning in these neural pathways for connection, right? And I usually have people list, I say, who are the 5 people that you spend the most time with? Not necessarily the people you're closest with, because to our nervous system, time spent stimulating a pathway means that pathway, whether it's one that you want or don't want, grows. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So let's say if you're stuck in a bad job, that still counts, right? As the
yes.
Okay.
Yes. Exactly. And so you have to kind of look at the overall package. And so it's based on a Likert scale. And so you'll answer the question. You'll say, okay, with Mary, I'll answer these 20 questions on a 1 to 5 scale. Do that for 5 people in your lives. And then you get sort of relative safety scores for those people, right? So if you're in a bad, and in, you know, it ends up being like 0 to 100. If you have, you know, your best friend who's just, it's the perfect relationship, and you spend, you know, 50% of your time in that relationship, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a score of 100 and 50% of your time there. But if you have a really terrible boss at work and you're 50% of your time there and that score is a 20, overall, right, you're not getting the full benefit of your great relationship because it's being chipped away at, you know. So it's all a balance in the nervous system, right, of what's being stimulated. And so what you want to look at then is kind of overall the level of safety of these relationships, the quality of the relationship. And on my website, you can actually take the assessment, and it self-tabulates as you're doing it. So if people want to do that, they can literally take it and it'll come up with numbers for your safety score. And then what it also does is it will give you a value for each of your pathways for connection, right? A relatively score, relative score for C. This is where the CARE comes from. CARE. Each of those letters stands for one of the pathways of connections. And so you're going to get a score for the relative strength of each of those pathways for connection, right? So you can look at that and say, geez, my vagal tone is pretty low. What can I do? So then ultimately what you want to do is do exercises, many of them are interpersonal, but exercises to strengthen the pathways for connection, right? Mm. And hopefully bring up those safety scores in all of your relationships.
Mm. Wow.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It sounds like a really, it's very sciencey, but I love that about it, actually.
Yeah. Well, it's sciencey and kind of fun. You know what I mean? It puts numbers on your relationship in a way, and it's not that numbers are better than anything. It allows you to sort of track, right?
Yeah.
Okay, how am I doing with this? And and literally just by reading the questions, you know, some of them about trust, some of them about, for instance, the dopamine reward system, which is E, you know, E in the CARE program, it stands for energy, and it's the energy that you get when your dopamine reward system is attached to healthy relationship, right? So that your most healthy relationships fill you with A, higher dopamine, which gives you energy, motivation to do things in your life, right? So, you know, some of it is about how much fun is the relationship? Are you laughing? Are, you know, that is a huge part of a healthy relationship. And you want a good E score, right? Mm. It sustains you.
Yeah. So work through the letters for us and we can know which one.
Yeah. So C, okay. So C is for sense C-A-R-E. Each one stands for a neural pathway, okay? C is for a sense of calm that you feel in a healthy relationship. I described the science behind that, and that was the science of the smart vagus nerve. So that when you have a strong vagus nerve, and you're in a healthy relationship, it feeds back to your stress response system and helps you feel calm, right? That's C. A, we haven't touched on. A is for a sense of accepted. And that's that feeling, that nice feeling of belonging that you have when you are in, you know, in your tribe or in with a close friend or even your family, if it's a good, healthy family. Mm-hmm. And that refers to research on the dorsal anterior cingulate gyrus, okay? And basically, it's research where folks looked at where in your brain, what area of your brain gets activated when you are socially excluded. Mm. Okay, they did this cyberball experiment, and to make a long story short, when a person is being socially excluded, this area of the dorsal anterior cingulate gyrus lights up, it's activated. And when they looked back to see what do we know about that, it's the same area that is activated for the distress of physical pain, right? Which is huge. So what that tells us is for human beings particularly, and again, it's probably somewhat like this for all mammals, being socially excluded is as dangerous as being physically injured, being ill. And so the alarm systems are one and the same, right?
Wow.
So it's activated. And so when it's activated, you feel pain. You feel real life pain, right? It's the heartache. It's the, you know, I mean, you can think about the metaphors we have, but your body responds to it like it's pain, which means your whole stress response gets activated, right?
Yeah.
And the scary thing is when you are a kid that has not belonged, if you're a kid that's been bullied or you've been ostracized or you've grown up as the, you know, the only black kid in a white school or the only X in a Y school, right? Then you have, this alarm system can become reactive, right? And read the world as being excluding.
Right.
Sometimes maybe even when it isn't, right? Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people that are, you know, have isms of whatever form in our country, and, you know, this is huge right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it, you know, when you talk about the immigration policies and gay rights and, you know, Black Lives Matter, I mean, this is all, in my mind, all about this dorsal anterior cingulate gyrus.
Right.
And the pain that is being activated, right?
Yeah.
So that's A. A is for sense of accepted. R is for sense of resonance. And resonance is that you feel in a good, healthy relationship, right? You know, when you can feel with that other person, what that is about is the mirror neuron system that we talked about. And it's the ability to read another person's actions, feelings, and emotions, right, without them even having to tell you. So that's the resonance system. And then finally, E is for energy. And that's the degree to which the relationship sort of fills you with joy or happiness and ultimately with dopamine that really produces motivation and, you know, energy for you to move forward in your life.
Mm. Yeah, because there's always somebody that you wind up interacting with in your life and you feel like they've sort of been like a Death Eater and sucked the life right out of you.
Exactly. They suck the life out of you, right? Right. Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's mm-hmm. really good. These all come, I don't know if I mentioned your book yet. It's called Wired to Connect, The Surprising Link Between Brain Science and Strong, Healthy Relationships. And it's in paperback now.
Yes.
And so and that was a name change. And so when people look for it, hopefully they'll find that right away. And there's all kinds of things people can see and learn in there. But the neat thing is that it's just so practical.
Right. Right. And that was what I was hoping for, really, is to somebody pick up a book and say, okay, and immediately do something to change the way they feel and the way their relationships are. Yeah.
And so a lot of it has to do with really kind of nurturing an awareness in ourselves of our connections and relationships and sort of minimizing the negative ones and strengthening mm-hmm. the positive ones, right?
Yes. Yes. Relational dilution, I call that.
Yeah. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So relational dilution, it goes back to that equation, that neurological equation, right? That mm-hmm. that the pathways grow by a simple formula of use it or lose it, right? Mm-hmm. So the more you feed the strong positive connections, the stronger those pathways will go, all four of those pathways, the vagal tone, you'll be less reactive, you'll feel less excluded, you'll be able to read other people, you'll be more energetic. But if you have that Death Eater, right, you have the life sucking out of you, the more that is front and center in a relationship, the less those pathways are being stimulated and the more the sympathetic nervous system is being stimulated. And so relational delusion is the simple ability to spend more time with healthier relationships, right? Thereby minimizing the neurological impact of the dangerous ones.
Mm. And I like the idea too, that you don't have to erect all these boundaries, just cut all these people out of your life.
Right.
And I've seen that with people who have had different kinds of abuse in their family in terms mm-hmm. of emotional abuse or something like that. And not yep. where they're in great peril, but they're like, that's it, I'm cutting these people out. And
yep.
and I think that it's a reactive response that I don't know makes a person more connected necessarily, because you kind of jump from one hurt relationship to the next one in a way.
That's right. You haven't learned anything, right? You mm-hmm. haven't learned the skill of how do you work through that. Now it doesn't mean that all of, you know, some relationships really, or some other people really can't do it. And, you know, they're wounded enough so that they don't have the skill set to be able to meet you. But, mm-hmm. you know, the book offers some simple, you know, ideas of if you want to try to approach somebody that you're struggling with, you know, how might you do that with, as you said, without just having to shut the door, you know, and get out. I mean, you know, if you go home, for instance, if you have a, you know, quote, intrusive mother who asks you too many questions and you just can't stand it and you're about to cut her out, you know, you know, how do you just say, I'm not comfortable answering that, right? I get it. You want to know? I'm not comfortable answering that. And if you know she's going to snowplow you, who do you need with you? Who do you need with you to just help you hold that line, you know, without having to just sever the relationship?
Yeah. That's really helpful. Do you have any other nuggets of wisdom before I ask you where people can find the website and the resources and your book?
Sure. You know, favorite easiest things that you can do, and it feels so ridiculous, but I think comes out of this culture where, you know, I'm in the Northeast, so, you know, people get, I think, the more north and the more east you get, people get more and more important to themselves, right? And one of the things that happens is people just don't even make eye contact, right? They don't look at each other. They don't say hi. You walk down a street. And you know, there are very basic things that are, you know, social skills 101 that can change your day. And it really can be as simple as going to the grocery store and, you know, saying hi to the person that that's bagging your groceries, or you're taking money from you, or, you know, if you're the bagger, you know, saying hello. And what happens, that's literally what people engage, they smile, their eyes light up, you hear differently, and it stimulates your smart vagus, which makes you feel calmer, right? Mm-hmm. It's this very simple thing that we forget all the time because we're lost in our heads. Our heads are in the phone. You know, we're not doing any of that. And I think that's just, you know, that's just one of those things you can take with you. And I think the other thing that I would say is, you know, I think we need to begin to have to teach everyone, but our young kids, some, you know, cultural context for the ways that being too independent undermines your ability to connect, right? Mm. And sort of, there needs to be this discernment that capitalism is really good at making money and really bad at making relationships and people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's confused all the time. We assume since it makes so much money, it's going to be good at building these other things. But it's that hyper-competitive actually does not work well with people.
Right. It's not, it doesn't necessarily help any kind of cooperation unless there's something else at stake. But sometimes you can cooperate just because it feels good, or, you know.
Yeah, well, you can cooperate because it feels good. And of course, there's a way to make money through cooperation rather than competition. You know what I mean? I mean, there's that there is a different way, right? A different way, a valid way, a way that utilizes your normal physiology and your normal desire to feel good with other people and feel healthy with other people, right? And we haven't harnessed that because we are the culture of, you know, of pioneers in uniqueness, and everybody has to have their own individuality, right? And nobody wants to blend in. That's like the worst thing, kiss of death, right?
Yeah, I'm interested to know. This is a total. Didn't expect to ask you this, but in the brain scans and studies that you've done, has it just been for Americans or people in North America?
No, there have been studies. There have been studies all over the world now, and in fact, some of the earliest work on mirror neurons was done in Parma, Italy. So this is all over the world. You know, and I interweave a lot of things in here, but. You know, what is clear, it is clear through a lot of different parameters from happiness to health and well-being that our culture, the American culture, is off the scales in that independence, that separation and independence. And that, for instance, this isn't a brain scan, but there was something called the Bloomberg's Indices of Health. It's a very complicated way of looking at physical health in people, right? In terms of access to health care, smoking, drinking, weight, all of this kind of stuff. In the United States in 2012, not so long ago, ranked number 33 in the nation behind the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and I think Chile and Cuba, right? So, you know, there are these warning signs that are saying, you know, something's not right here. Something just isn't right here, and we're not paying attention.
Right. It's disturbing, too. I've done some work with suicide prevention, and it's, you know, 40,000 people in the U.S. are taking their own lives. And depression is off the chart, and it's really, really disturbing. I can't help but to think it's because we aren't realizing that we are social creatures. And when you are, I've struggled with my own depression, and I know that depression doesn't like social contact helps it dissipate for me, and
that's right.
Making sure I don't feel in depressed mood alone, that someone else knows. And it's not like it magically disappears, but it doesn't, certainly is not helped by isolation.
Exactly. And I think that's most everybody's experience, right? And then when you're handed this line of, you know, that you're kind of weak if you turn to people, it's really complicated, you know. So at best, I think people get a mixed message about, you know, being able to be in connection and having other people support you and what that looks like and what that feels like, right? But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in my group really sort of talks about disorders of disconnection. And once you look at it through this lens, which is really one more that's more about the neurophysiology of connection, then you can see, I mean, I think depression, anxiety, heart disease, eating disorders, drugs of addiction. I mean, all of that are really disorders of disconnection, I think, in some way or another. You know, and it's sort of like I would love to see people like harnessing resources, right, that sort of approach it from that angle. Right. But of course, to do that, it sort of upsets the apple cart of the feeder system for capitalism. I mean, I think that's the big struggle.
And just that kind of pull yourself up by the bootstraps and don't need anybody else kind of thing. And even sort of the backlash of, oh, your kids are boomerang kids and they can't do it. And it's like, well, there could be something to say for just the family striking out together and everybody helping each other, but they don't have to be shamed because they, haven't been able to have the funds to make it on their own. But there's this whole generation that gets shamed for not having the money to be all alone, living alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, you haven't made it. Right? Yeah. You haven't made it. What do you mean you haven't made it? You hadn't left home. I mean, right.
And what if this tremendous shift happens where you know multiple generations were actually living in one house? I don't think that America would collapse, right?
Well, exactly, right? Like the rest of the world, where that's been happening for a bazillion years.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's really ridiculous, right?
So,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. I mean, it's taken, and I think people, you get, you know, it's like the frog in the broth as it's heating up. Mm-hmm. I think people don't even get how hot it is here,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And you know, so you're just ingesting this all the time with no discernment about what you're taking in. It's just the background noise all the time. And that feeds our nervous systems in a certain direction. And the direction, unfortunately, is towards stress, right?
Right. Yeah, stress and disease and premature death.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what stress does.
Wow.
Right.
Well,
exactly.
This has been pretty incredible. I'm so grateful that you had come on my show. And maybe you can tell everybody where are the best places to find you.
Yeah, sure. Right now in my car. So go. My organization is the Jean Baker Miller Training Organization, and it's at jbmti.org. So that's one place. My website is amybanksmd.com, and that's where they can find lots of information about the CARE program. They can actually buy the book. You know, they have links to lots of kind of talks that I've given, newspaper articles, that kind of stuff, so they can get a lot of information there. I also have on Psychology Today, I have a blog called Wired to Love. People can find me there. I think those are good places.
Excellent. Are you on any social media at all, Twitter or Facebook?
I am, sorry, yes, Twitter. What is my Twitter thing? I think it's Amy Banks MD.
Okay, that's good. I have show notes. I have show notes that I will put everything. I'll double check everything, and I'll put everything in there too. Thank you so much.
Yeah, but you can see my age is preceding me. That I don't even think of what is my Twitter thing, right?
You're not often quizzed about it, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's true.
Well, this has been so wonderful. I really appreciate your time.
Lovely to talk to you.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass, and you can access the access pass for just $1. It unlocks all show note episodes, too. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.